So Luke 15 today, this chapter consists of three parables that teach us God's heart toward the lost, His compassionate work in retrieving the lost. And these parables are all striking at the same main truth that every lost soul is of extreme value to the Lord, and that all of heaven rejoices when one lost soul comes to the Lord. And yet, as you're going to see in the course of our study, as we study through these three different parables, there is uniqueness and difference within each parable, so that in each one, we are going to be picking up from those individual parables side truths that we can apply to our main thought, supports for our main thought, and yet from those differences in the parables, it's going to broaden our understanding of those main truths that all three of these parables are striking at. So let's get going here in verse 1. We'll begin reading and working our way through this. I expect to get through at least the first 8 verses, the parable of the lost sheep, and I'm hoping to get through the second parable today, the parable of the lost coin. We'll get as far as we can, but for sure we're going to hold that last parable in this chapter, which is by far the largest parable of the three, the parable of the prodigal son. We'll put all of our focus on that next week. So verse 1, "Then all the tax collectors and the sinners drew near to him to hear him." Verse 2, "And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.'" Well, that is a really lousy attitude for the clergy to have, isn't it? That's what these guys are. These are the clergy, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. They were the religious leaders of the day. And this was their attitude toward sinners. Their attitude toward sinners was that if spiritually you did not have it all together, then you could expect to be shunned by them. And I'm thinking I need to get in one spot and just stay put. And that's not the spot. Now, can you imagine if Anchored Fellowship was like that? Like these religious clergy from back in the first century, that our approach to seeking sinners was this: make sure that you already have a healthy relationship with God before you come to one of our services. Make sure spiritually, physically, emotionally, mentally, you are completely healed before you show up and join up with us. Be sure that you have a consistent track record of godliness before you even dare think about linking arms with the likes of us, the spiritual elite, Anchored Fellowship. Can you imagine that kind of attitude toward the seeking sinner? And yet, that really is the attitude that these clergymen had. They saw the sinner, the seeking sinner. This is kind of fun. Adds a whole nother element to preaching, like whack-a-mole. So these first century clergymen saw not just sinners, but even open seeking sinners as aliens to avoid. But Jesus saw them as individual, special souls to save. So it's no wonder then that seeking sinners were attracted to Jesus and completely turned off by these religious leaders. Their thinking was this: we are so holy that we dare not defile ourselves by hanging out with sinners. We don't want to get sinner cooties. We got to keep ourselves pure. Now, that was what kept the religious leaders from attracting, or I should say, that is what kept the religious leaders from the sinners, but that's not what kept these seeking sinners from the religious leaders. It wasn't their holiness That wasn't the turnoff to the seeking sinner, because they weren't as holy as they thought they were. And that was a lot of the problem here. The Apostle Paul teaches us in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, to cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and the spirit. So Paul's teaching us there are sins of the flesh. These are the open, visible, obvious ones. That first crowd would fall into that. A crowd that struggled with the sins of the flesh. It was just apparent, you know. These were outward sins. But the Apostle Paul teaches us there are also sins of the spirit. These aren't visible things. These are internal problems. These are internal sins that can't be seen or known but by anyone except the Lord and the individual with those internal sinful problems. Jesus diagnosed these religious leaders with this problem, didn't he? He said, you guys are really good at cleansing the outside of the cup, but inside the cup is wickedness. That was in Luke. We recently covered that not all that long ago. Luke chapter 11, verse 39. Can you imagine that, going to someone's house and they only wash the outsides of their cups? Might not be a good place to have coffee. We save time here. We only wash the outsides of the cups. That's what the religious leaders did spiritually. They looked good externally. If you were looking for sins of the flesh, you might be impressed by them. But if you were God who examines the heart, you'd see all of the internal corruption. So it wasn't holiness that was turning off the crowds for the religious leaders. To show you that, we have Jesus as the contrast, because Jesus, on the other hand, was perfect in holiness. And yet that did not turn off the seeking sinner, did it? Though he was perfect in holiness, the crowds loved Jesus. The crowds felt received by Jesus. So once and for all, we know it's not holiness that repels the seeking sinner. It's our bad attitude, and it's our misunderstanding about our own holiness. That's the problem. When we believe we're too cool for school, when we believe we're too good for other people, that's the problem. That's the turnoff, not holiness. So to these guys, man, this is a slam. This is an awful accusation to level against Jesus, that he receives sinners and has the audacity to sit down with them at a meal. That was a very intimate and personal and approving kind of thing for a first century Jew to do. You only sat down to eat with people that you were on eye level with, people that were like you, people that fit your mold and your belief system and your degree of holiness. So for him to do this, what a terrible thing, they thought. But for those of us who have our doctrinal ducks in a row, this is a glorious truth about Christ, that he receives sinners and will even eat with them, dine with them. We know that is a metaphor for relationship, communion, and fellowship. So what a great truth for us that whether our sins are external or internal, whether we are somewhat put together in life, or whether we are absolute sinful disasters, that the truth about this is that it's whosoever will. If you'll just come to the Lord, he will receive you. He told us that all that the Father gives him, all that come to him, he will in no ways, by no wise, cast them out. He'll receive all. What was the invitation to the religious people in Luke chapter 14? It was this: come to the table. Come in fellowship with me. Come and eat with me, and I'll receive. That was to the religious leaders. What was his message to the unreligious people there at the dinner? Same thing. Come to the table. Come to me. Commune with me. Fellowship with me, and you'll be received. So it's the same invitation, no matter where you stand. Personally, I am so glad that the Lord receives sinners. That's the only reason I'm here. It's the only reason I'm here. He received me as a sinner. He didn't turn me away. He received me. In Luke chapter 7, 34, Jesus acknowledged that the religious leaders accused him of being friends of sinners. Pardon me, the friend of sinners. And Jesus didn't mind that moniker at all. Right on, that's true. I am the friend of sinners. Not to be like them, not for them to rub off on me, but for me to rub off on them. Not for them to change my manner of living, but for me to change their manner of living. So let me ask you, are you a friend of the seeking sinner? Or are you too good for them because you're saved? Boy, did it get quiet in here. Oh, you know, sinners don't really like me. Even seeking sinners, because I'm so holy, it makes them uncomfortable. I'm one of the anchored elite, and they know that. They know my status in the church, and that makes them uncomfortable. No, it is not your salvation, it is not your holiness that makes sinners uncomfortable. It's your religious stuffiness. Now, I'm not talking to anyone here. That's for the Facebook Live crowd, of course. It's not holiness. Holiness is attractive to the world. It's something they don't have. Verse 3. So he spoke this parable to them. Now, it goes without saying Jesus disagreed with the religious leaders. He does not think that it is a negative thing for him to be compassionate and welcoming to the seeking sinner. Therefore, everything else that he's going to say in this chapter is to that end. He's telling them about the right heart toward the lost sinner. He's telling them about the right actions to take in order to retrieve the lost sinners. And he's going to put this in terms that even they can understand, not necessarily embrace, but he's going to put this in terms that they can understand. The first parable is about a shepherd. That's going to appeal to the men. The second parable is about a woman. That's going to appeal to the woman. He's hitting with relevancy every single person in his audience. He has something in these stories to reach them. Verse 4. What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? Anchored, make sure you hear this. I am not going to feel comfortable until I know that you know this. It's important to me that you know this. This shepherd is not abandoning the 99 contented and disciplined sheep that have not run off. He's not abandoning them in the middle of the wilderness, just sort of letting them go loose while he runs off to retrieve the one that went missing. He is not leaving them to feed themselves or fend for themselves. He's not leaving them hopeless and helpless. He's the good shepherd, not the careless shepherd. He said in John 10 that those who enter the sheepfold will be saved. That means you're safe when you come into the sheepfold. You're safe. He said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. Now, do you remember last year? We just need to go back to a corded mic, don't we? That is the only thing you could trust. Do you remember last year during a vacation time that I took that we played one of my old teachings for you from John 10? Do you remember that? We joked about me being here even though I wasn't. Well, in that John 10 teaching about the good shepherd, I taught that there were city sheepfolds and country sheepfolds. Do you remember that? And we taught about communal shepherds too in that teaching. And that is the sort of thing that Jesus is, of course, not including in the message, but it's something you should pick up, that when those shepherds moved out of their city sheepfolds and were taking the sheep grazing through the wilderness, they had makeshift sheepfolds set up, yes, even in the wilderness, so that there was safety and protection there. That is the sort of thing that's happening here. This shepherd is not just abandoning them to themselves, but obviously they are in a sheepfold. Obviously there would be an under shepherd protecting and caring for those sheep as this main shepherd goes off to find that lost sheep. But keep in mind, this is a human story, so the parable falls a little bit short to teach us all of the depth of God. We know the depth of God is this. He's not confined to locality as a human shepherd is. A human shepherd's got to be in one place or the other with the 99 or out looking for the one. But our good shepherd, we know, is God. And because our good shepherd is God, he doesn't have to leave the sheep to go find the other. So you can just strike that from your thinking one way or another. He will never abandon us. Now, before we move on, I want you to notice something about Jesus. He doesn't run his sheepfold like a business. When it comes to business, there's a bottom line. Usually it has to do with dollars and cents. And you account for loss and even expect loss when you're running a business. So you leave yourself cushion in your business so that when loss does happen, it's no big deal. You've prepared for that eventuality. Now, if Jesus ran the sheepfold like a business, then it might not be such a big deal to lose 1 out of 100 sheep. Church, that's only 1%. I mean, that's like the... Well, never mind. That's only 1%. I'm going to get myself in trouble yet here today. 1%, you think to yourself, that's not a bad deal, losing 1%. We calculate for such things. So it's not worth the risk of running off after the one. We've built that cushion into our numbers. So one sheep here and there, well, that's okay because they're expendable. We've got the numbers. Not to Christ. Not to Christ. The sheepfold to Christ is not a business, and not one soul is expendable to him. Jesus teaches in the Gospels that God gives him every soul that is supposed to come to him. And Jesus said, I won't lose one of those souls that come to me. When the Father has designated for someone to be saved, there's no way that soul gets away from Jesus. So numbers are not his bottom line when it comes to the sheepfold. Money is not his bottom line. Souls, individual souls, are his bottom line. We could say it like this. You are his bottom line. Your safety, your protection, your well-being. He cares enough about you that you're just not a face or faceless person in a large crowd of people. But to him, he loves you and cares for you like you're the only one. I love that about the Lord. It's so personal and individual. His bottom line is this. He wants to rescue you. He wants to save you. Verse 5. And when he has found it, when he has found this sheep, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. It's a beautiful picture. You've probably seen photos, frames, portraits of Jesus carrying a little sheep on his shoulders. Beautiful picture that is being painted here. Now, there's only a few possibilities that I can think of as to why this sheep gets a free ride on the shoulders of the shepherd back to the sheepfold. Possibility number one, this sheep has wandered extremely far from the safety of the sheepfold. The sheepfold would be what? The church. And he's run extremely far from the safety of his shepherd. The shepherd would be Jesus. And it could be, possibility number one, that this sheep, in wandering off and running from the shepherd, has completely and utterly exhausted itself. Man, if this was about a lost cow, that would have been a good joke. Utterly exhausted. It's about a lost sheep, though. So that could be the case. Because you know what it's like to run from God. At least I bet you do. It is completely exhausting. It completely wears you out and runs you into the ground. You know, when people say, when you ask them, why haven't you been at church? Did you, you know, what's going on? Are you not with the Lord anymore? And they'll say something like this, well, I just left because I needed to go find myself. I hate those statements. I hate when I see that. So many times I've seen spouses post that, I'm finding myself. And in the process, they end up losing their spouse. What do you know? I found myself right out of this marriage. People do that with the Lord too. I'm leaving the church for a while. I'm leaving the flock. I'm leaving the shepherd because I need to go find myself. They're not going to find themselves. What they're really doing is they're going and getting themselves lost. And when you get good and lost and completely exhausted and you finally collapse, that's when the shepherd shows up. And chances are, if that's your condition, the Lord knows that when he finds you, when he retrieves you, the first thing you need is rest. That's what he said to religious people. Are you burdened down? You wore out? You exhausted? Come to me. I will give you rest. I'll carry you on my shoulders for a while. So there you have, you know, the whole footprints thing. Two footprints out as the sheep is wandering and straying, but one set of footprints back. The Lord is carrying this sheep. Possibility number two of why this sheep is getting the free ride back to the sheepfold on the shoulders of the shepherd is this, that this sheep has separated itself from the protection and provision of the shepherd and therefore has been wounded by a predator or weakened from malnutrition. I'd say that one is very, very likely. That's what you do when you run from God. He's not pushing you out. He's not running from you. You're running from him. You're running from divine protection and provision. That defense that he brings to you, that care, that supplying of good things that are necessary for you, that's all gone when you wander off, when you run. So chances are when he finds you, you're in bad shape and you need carried. Here's possibility number three. It could be because this sheep was a chronic wanderer. And when a sheep was a chronic wanderer, the shepherd had to go to drastic measures to prevent that from happening again, to cure that chronic wandering sheep from its chronic wandering. That was another subject from our John 10 video that we played for you that week that I was here, and yet I wasn't. That was another topic on there. That if a sheep was prone to wander, the shepherd would have no choice but to teach it a hard lesson, to apply some tough love to the situation, and he would snap one of its leg bones. We say, oh, that's mean. That he would inflict pain on a dumb sheep that doesn't know any better. He didn't do that to be mean. He did that because he loved that sheep. He cared about that sheep, and he wanted to correct an internal problem with that sheep. So he would break one of its legs and then he would reset the bone and bandage the leg. And when he did that to a chronic wandering sheep, what that meant was that shepherd was committing himself to that sheep to carry that sheep until that sheep healed, because that sheep could not walk on its own. So it was a long commitment of time and energy from the shepherd to teach this lesson, snap the leg and reset the bone and bandage the leg. But now he's got to carry this sheep everywhere it goes until it is healed well enough to walk. And the really cool thing about that is that in the process of doing that, that sheep would spend so much time on the shoulders of the shepherd that by the time that sheep was healed and ready to walk, the closeness, that bond that generated between the shepherd and that sheep was so strong that that sheep was forever cured of its chronic wandering. Man, I like that. This is what David was referring to in his prayer of confession over the sin against Bathsheba and Uriah in Psalm 51, verses 7 and 8, when he said this, "Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me hear joy and gladness." Listen to this last line. "That the bones you have broken may rejoice." Sometimes the only way the good shepherd can keep you from wandering away from the safety of the fold is to immobilize you so that you can't, and get close to you in order to cure you of that propensity. That doesn't mean he's literally going to snap your legs. You can still get into a lot of trouble if you have a broken leg. It means he's going to do whatever he has to do in your life to shut you off from certain things, to keep you from having the accessibility to go off in places that aren't healthy for you, and confine you a little bit more so that you stay in a healthy place until you've learned the lesson. So today, if you're thinking about wandering off from the Lord, if you're thinking you don't need his protection and his provision, would you remember this? That the world and sinful living will exhaust you and deplete you of all energy and joy. It will beat you up and break you down. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 13:15 that the way of the unfaithful is hard. I like this better in the King James Version. It says, "The way of the transgressor is hard." That's a tough way to live. You ever ask someone why they're not saved? Why haven't you come to the Lord? And they say something like this: "It's too hard. Serving God is too hard. Following Jesus is too hard. It's too stringent of a lifestyle. It's too constricting. It smothers me. It's too hard." No, following the Good Shepherd is not hard. That's the good life. Following the Good Shepherd is the good life. Let me tell you what's hard. What's hard is wandering away from the shepherd that cares for you and protects you and provides for you. Wandering away from that, getting yourself lost out there in the world on your own, by your own doing, and trying to navigate life without the help of the good shepherd. That's what's hard. The way of the unfaithful is hard. The way of the transgressor is hard. The way of the sheep that follows the good shepherd, that's the good life. Maybe you're like me today. The Lord has had to break some of your bones along the way, metaphorically speaking. And in Wesley's case, literally speaking. Maybe the Lord has had to break some of your bones along the way, and you too have reached the point, as I have, where you just say, "All right, Lord, I got it. I learned my lesson for good. I'm not going to wander off on you anymore." That's a tough life. Living without you, that's a tough life. And I have no help. But living with you is the good life. I've learned, and Lord, I'm going to stay. I'm not going to be a wanderer anymore. Verse 6. "And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.'" Now, can I just go ahead and cut to the chase here and directly apply this? Here's the statement. His friends and neighbors rejoice with him when a lost soul is found and returned to the safety of his care. His real friends won't grumble over what the Lord brings home. "Lord, what did you drag in here? What did you drag into the sheepfold today, Lord? That thing is a mess. That thing is a broken, bloody mess. That thing doesn't look prim and proper like the rest of us mature Christians." What did you drag in here today? Lord, this person that you've brought, this seeking sinner that you've welcomed in, they don't fit our mold. We have a thing going here. We have a theme at Anchored. We have a certain standard, a certain etiquette. Lord, that person's got a green spiked mohawk and cheek piercings. They don't fit us. Well, be careful, because what Jesus is revealing to the religious leaders here, remember this whole thing, these parables started because they weren't rejoicing over the seeking sinners that were coming to Christ. Jesus is giving them this truth. If you're upset about the sinners that are coming to me, if you're upset about the messes that come to me that I might clean them up, then the implication is this: you're not really one of my friends. Because my friends rejoice when a lost soul comes home to be with the Lord. Now, before we read this next verse, I want you to know that the religious leaders had a common saying back then. And it went like this: there is joy in heaven when one sinner, there is joy in heaven when one sinner is obliterated. Now, that shouldn't surprise you. This is the place that these religious leaders had come to in the first century. They never should have been in this place, but that's where they were. They had some crazy thoughts. They used to pray every day, "Lord, I thank you that I'm not a Gentile, a dog, or a woman." That's what they prayed. "Don't be mad at me. I'm just passing along the message. I didn't say that." That's what they prayed. They were very biased and prejudiced. And if it came to Gentiles or even Jews that were sinners, they believed that this was fodder for the fires of hell. And that was their saying. There's joy in heaven when one sinner is obliterated. You can see where they might feel that way. We as Christians want to have sin eradicated from the planet. That would be a wonderful state of living for all of us. But we're not saying, "Hey, we'd be really happy if God just killed all sinners right now. Everyone that's not saved, Lord, just wipe them out." That's not our heart. That was their heart. There's joy in heaven when one sinner is obliterated. Now, because Jesus knew that common saying, listen to what he said at the end of this parable, verse 7. "I say to you, likewise, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who," what? Not who is obliterated, but "over one sinner who repents, over the 99 just persons who need no repentance." Now, just persons, we understand that does not mean perfect persons. They're not perfect people. They're just people. They're justified. That means they are people that are in right standing with God. Yes, that is possible. It doesn't mean you're perfect. It just means that in those moments where you're not perfect, you bring that to the Lord, you confess that, he forgives, and you once again resume that right standing with God. That's what just or justified means. These are justified sheep, the 99. They're mature. They get it. They're doing the right things in the sheepfold. But when one lost sheep is brought back into that sheepfold, all of heaven erupts in celebration. I love verses 7 and 10. There is joy in heaven when how many sinners repent? Is it 100? Is it 50? Surely it's a bulk thing, a mass thing, right? If there's enough sinners that get saved in one service, then there's celebration in heaven, right? No. When just one soul repents and is cleansed in the heart and is indwelt by the Spirit and becomes a part of the sheepfold, the church, all of heaven rejoices over that. One great thing about not being a mega church right now, I mean, we could list out the cons like our faulty technological equipment, but one great thing about not being a mega church right now is we're really not in the position to take individual souls for granted. We're not in the position to view them as numbers. There are some huge churches, some mega churches out there that on a regular week-by-week basis, they'll see 50 to 100 people converted, giving their lives to Christ, coming to Christ, coming to the Great Shepherd, entering into the sheepfold every Sunday service, 50 to 100. And unfortunately, because they're so big, it's real easy to get off center with the focus. And for some of those mega churches, there's that propensity, that tendency to get the mind off the individual soul and get the mind on the numbers. So when they have a week where there's only, say, like 20 people that get saved, they're a little bit bummed out. Oh man, only 20 saved today. Pastor must not have brought his best stuff today. Only 20 souls saved. That's a shame. Well, we just have to make sure that our focus as a church stays where it is. And if we did become a large church, no matter how large we got, we have to keep this commitment that we never get our focus off of viewing souls and onto counting numbers. When one sheep comes to the shepherd, heaven erupts in celebration. And so should we. Always, every soul that comes to Christ here is a soul that we can rejoice and celebrate over and welcome into the Anchored family. The Lord brought them and we get to celebrate them. Don't you love that? Nothing excites me like seeing people give their hearts to Christ and come to know Him and join our little church family here. Verse 8, we move on to the parable of the lost coin. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it. Verse 9. And when she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I lost." Verse 10. Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, I can relate to finding lost coins. You probably can too. It happens every time I pull up the cushions from my couch. I can relate to that. Lots of quarters, dimes, lots of pennies. I can relate to finding the lost coins. What I can't relate to right off the bat without a little more understanding here is someone throwing a party because they found lost coins. You ever do that? Come on over, let's celebrate. I found some loose change in the couch. Let's have a barbecue. I don't know, maybe we should start doing that. Maybe next time I find change in the couch or under the dresser, I'll invite you over and we'll have a barbecue and celebrate the coins. Maybe you're wondering, what's the big deal about a lost coin? Is it really all that important? And the answer to that would be, the fuss over the silver coin is rather important. It is a big deal. This wasn't just about losing some pocket change and finding the pocket change. The language of this parable tips us off to the full meaning. You see, in those days, when a woman was married or betrothed to be married, her husband or her husband-to-be would present to her a silver chain that she would wear around her head. And hanging from that silver chain were 10 silver coins. You see that right in the language of the parable. Maybe you've watched some movies about that time and that culture, Jesus of Nazareth and several of those other movies where you've seen that a woman wearing those 10 coins around her as a headdress. That was essentially their wedding rings. They didn't use wedding rings like we do to say, "Hey, I'm married." That was a Roman thing. The Romans started that. So for them, that silver headdress with the 10 silver coins for a woman, that was essentially her wedding ring. Her husband gave her to that to say, "Hey, you're going to be my wife, or you are my wife. You are of great value to me. Here's an expensive headdress." And she would wear that as a married woman to make the statement, "I am married to that man." So this was more than just a coin. It was a symbol of a relationship. You know, when we do the ring ceremonies at services, wedding services, we say, "What token, what symbol do you bring as a symbol of your eternal love for that other person?" That's what this was. So the fact that she loses it is similar to like a woman who has a nice wedding ring and one of the diamonds pops out of it, or one of the fake diamonds. Hey, we don't judge here. Whatever you got, whatever you have. If there's one diamond in it and that diamond pops out, all the more reason for you to find that. You lost a diamond from your wedding ring. That wedding ring is more than just a thing. That speaks to your relationship, your marital relationship. Very important that you find it. That is the situation that this woman is in. That's what's at stake for this woman. Now, there are some differences between these two parables that we covered today. It's no longer a shepherd, it's a woman. It's no longer a lost sheep, it's a lost coin. It's no longer in the wilderness, it's right there in the home. But the meaning behind both of these parables are the same. The Lord is comparing a lost soul to a lost sheep that is loved and wanted. He's comparing a lost soul to a silver coin that is sentimental, special, and of great value and great purpose. And think about the unstated implications here of the value of this coin, or the value of this sheep for that matter. That coin is very valuable. And that coin serves a purpose, but only when that coin is in its proper place. That same coin, when it is lost, has lost its value and its purpose. It's been disconnected from its value and its purpose. The coin hasn't changed, but its place has changed, and therefore that has changed its value and its purpose. When that coin was lost, when that sheep was lost, so was the value and the purpose. For example, you get a COVID-19 check, stimulus check. That check has a value and a purpose. Its value is $1,200. Its purpose is to buy you a new 70-inch LG TV or whatever it is that you're going to buy. It has a value and a purpose when it's in your hand and en route to the bank. But if you lose that check and it gets wedged down into the crevices of your couch and you can't find it, that whole time that it's lost, it is of no value to you and it serves no purpose. You know, that's the same for souls. I know this is a tough thing to say. Non-Christians don't like to hear this. Are you saying we non-Christians have no value in the world? Are you saying we have no purpose in life? No, I'm saying the opposite. I'm saying you were created by God with a great value on your life. He emblazoned His image on you. You were created in His image. You have great intrinsic, infinite, eternal value. And He created you, each one of us, individually, with a divine purpose. And all I'm saying is that when you're lost, when you're wandering away from the shepherd, when you're separated from Him, you are separated from that eternal value and eternal purpose for which He has for your life. It's no wonder that when you come back, we anchored people get really happy. And all of heaven, the angels of heaven, rejoice too. Something of infinite eternal value and divine purpose has been returned into the right hands. You've come back to the Lord. Well, we'll reserve for next week the longest of the three parables. It really diverges us off into a different train of thought. In these first two parables, it's all about what the Lord does to get the lost back. It's His choices. It's His work. It's His tracking down. It's His recovery. When we get to next week, we're going to see the other side of this equation. We're going to see the lost son, and we're going to see how free will also plays a role in you coming back to the Lord. So we'll talk about that. We'll save that for next week. The rest of you, would you stand with me?